G'day folks, talk to Sherry Byrne-Haber, a leader of accessibility in the tech world, where she has a history of successfully architecting strategic global accessibility programs in the digital environment, app, web, everything in between, accessibility throughout, paving the way. Doing great work, coming out of the tech hub of California. Solid. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. Be much appreciated. I want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Sherry Byrne-Haber, much appreciated for jumping on the podcast, you know, all the way from California. So,
Thanks for inviting me.
Welcome.
Thanks. I'm originally from the East Coast of Canada, so that would have been even further. But, you know, California to Australia is manageable.
Yeah, it's a bit closer. Because what's the distance between, say, east to west? Is it like a 4.5 hour plane ride or?
To the east coast of the United States?
Yeah, where you're from.
It's more like 6. If you're just going a straight shot, San Francisco to DC, you can do it in 5.5. But if you're going San Francisco to anywhere in the Northeast, it's a bit longer.
Okay. So whereabouts are you from over on the East Coast there?
Yeah, so my family's all originally from this little province in Canada that nobody has ever heard of, even Canadians don't always know about it, called New Brunswick. So it's northeast of Maine.
Oh, northeast of Maine, because you've got just below Maine, you got that's Massachusetts, yeah? Okay, now I know where you are.
Yeah, so, and then in Newfoundland, which is a couple more provinces over to the east, they actually have the time zone is 4.5 hours, not 4 hours, not 5 hours, four and a half.
So right next to like sort of in between like Nova Scotia and Ontario, yeah?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a bit of a move going from all the way up northeast to, you know, down to California where it's, the weather would be drastically different too, yeah?
It's drastically nicer. The weather is California's one saving grace, I think, sometimes. But I've been here I've been here two chunks of my life. The last chunk of my life I've been here since 93. So it's been quite a while.
Okay. So how are you handling it amongst like in California? The weather's nice, but the thing that ain't nice is bloody COVID in the mix. So how are you handling it with that?
Like yeah, so the full COVID on. The COVID shutdown here is pretty serious. We're finally, I think, seeing the light at the end of the tunnel from our our Christmas Thanksgiving surge where people didn't pay attention to what the government officials were saying. So I have several different autoimmune conditions. I literally have not left my house for almost a year, except for contactless grocery pickup and doctor's appointments that I can't do by the telephone. One of my daughters is in healthcare. She managed to contract COVID, but fortunately she got over it. I've lost two elderly relatives, so that part really sucked.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah. You know, I just want to reach out and smack people with a baseball bat when they talk about, you know, only a few people will die. And it's like, well, that few people was my 91-year-old aunt and my 85-year-old uncle who were having perfectly good lives up until that point and could have, you know, lasted for a good bit longer if people hadn't been so irresponsible about not wearing masks.
That's right. Yeah, because I've seen, like in the media, just how it can spread, like it's so easy just to transmit. So
well, and especially with the new variants, I guess they say that the new variants are going to be taking over. They're going to be the majority strain, and that's the super contagious one. So, yep. you know,
yeah, the South African one.
And the AstraZeneca vaccine doesn't work against the South African variant, apparently. I just read that in the news this morning. Yep. So assuming that that's trustworthy, that's not good.
Yeah.
But I'll hopefully have a vaccine for something in the next few months. And then maybe life will get back to passing for normal. And if it's just getting a jab in your arm once a year, like it is for the flu shot, then it isn't a big deal. But we're not there yet.
Yeah, well, I hope they really sort of knock it on the head. Like, you know, it takes years to get vaccines up and working properly. And, you know, you got the whole world, like you got a bit of an arms race trying to get it all sorted out, and they're doing the best that they can. But yeah, the sooner the better, hey? So,
and then we all chase each other's tails, right? Because if you look at the flu shot, how do the Americans decide what strains to vaccinate against? We look at Australia. Because it's whatever you had going around in your winter is going to be what's going around in our winter.
That's right. And who knows?
And sometimes they get it right and sometimes they don't.
Yeah, that's it. But, you know, I'd rather, you know, have it than not. Like, you know, like at the end of the day, you know, I'm a C5C6 incomplete quadriplegic, and I'll do, you know, take anything if it's, you know, if it's researched and peer reviewed, if it's going to help me in any way, shape, or form to do with respiratory or health in general. Yep. So, Same here. It's very important. That's good. And yourself, Sherry, you're talking about your immune system. So let's kick it off and, you know, tell us a bit about yourself and where it's got to do with your immune system and disability. And if we want to jump into the world of, you know, who you are before we start sort of going into the scope of what you've involved in to do with digital accessibility.
Sure. So I managed to develop both type 1 diabetes and rheumatoid arthritis in my late 20s. And those, I wouldn't say exactly their co-diagnosis, but for me, they came about maybe 3 years apart. So it did seem that they could have possibly been related, that my the type 1 diabetes, which you normally get as a child, I managed to get it as an adult, but that it had probably caused my immune system to go haywire. And so I ended up getting other, autoimmune conditions at the same time. Which is funny because I use a wheelchair to get around for longer distances. I was born with club feet and kyphoscoliosis. So I had a number of orthopedic surgeries when I was a child and, you know, had to wear braces and casts for years. But you know, so people look at me and they think, okay, she's talking about disability. She's a wheelchair user. Obviously, her disability is related to her wheelchair use. And in reality, you know, I view my wheelchair as a way of getting around, right? Mm. It's, you know, it's because I can't walk long distances without risking getting a fracture. It gets me from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. But every piece of food I put in my mouth, I have to think about. Every time I exercise, I have to think about. Anytime I get stressed or sick or don't get enough sleep, all of those things impact my insulin intake, right? Mm. So if you're talking about what beats me up day in, day out in terms of being a disability, what impacts my ability to participate in birthday parties and, you know, go out for a late night with some friends, it's the diabetes. It's not the wheelchair.
Yeah. It's like you've got to, you know, before pretty much you open your eyes of a morning, you've already the night before you've planned your day out because you've got to be methodical in a sense, yeah?
Yeah. And you know, I happen to live in an area that's got a lot of power outages. And so it's like, okay, what am I going to do to keep my insulin cold? You know, if I have to evacuate because of wildfires, you know, do I have everything in one place where I can just throw my insulin in the cooler, grab everything and, you know, bolt to my car for the, you know, the trip up the fire road. We were about 6 kilometers from the one of the fires in the Santa Cruz Mountains last year. And we've had a couple of close ones where I live.
So can you explain like just whereabouts in California that is, like if you're looking at, say, because a lot of people, if it's in Australia or other parts of the world, if they think California, like they know you're like LA, San Fran. So if you're looking, say, between those two points, whereabouts are you?
So I'm about 80 kilometers south of San Francisco at the top of the mountain that makes Silicon Valley a valley. Mm. So, I mean, mountain, you know, I'm making air quotes around that. It's not really much of a mountain. It's about 1,100 feet elevation. So maybe, you know, not, yeah, 350 meters. You know, we like it up here. It's a good place to get away from the hustle and bustle of living in the valley, which is a much busier place to live.
Yeah. Okay. No, let's, and so you're talking about you're there with your family. Yeah. So you, what are you there with a couple of youngsters, kids, or just,
You know, I have two young adults, one of whom is finishing up grad school and one of whom is doing college from home this semester. You know, my other daughter lives with her husband in San Francisco itself. And my parents still live in Silicon Valley. So yeah, They're not too far away.
Oh, well, that's good. You got a, you know, a bit of family about, so, which is,
yeah,
great.
For sure.
Well, and let's reel it back. So if we look, like, now we're looking in the scope of accessible technologies, but like, where did it all start? Because I can see, I've seen you've built a bit of a career in the corporate world of it, and which is great. You know, we need people in all different sectors of disability to help, you know, raise awareness and just show the general public of what people with disabilities can do, you know.
Yeah.
Just to level the playing field.
If people pay attention to what it is they need, which honestly isn't that complicated.
Mm.
So I was actually, this is my proud Sherry fact. I was the first girl in the United States to do a Girl Scout badge in computer science. So that was a while ago. I was annoyed. I didn't like, you know, babysitting and baking and all of the badges that were available. Tried to get into Boy Scouts. Yep. They weren't having it at that point, although they have changed their policies now. And so I ended up doing one of those design yourself badges for computers, because computers were my thing back then. My father had brought home a computer. He was an executive with one of the first Silicon Valley startups. And he said, it's better for you to play with this than watch TV, learn how to use it.
So was your family,
when I was stuck home, you know.
So was your family, so did you go from the East Coast, did you move over to the West Coast when you were young? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Originally we moved here when I was 8, and then I moved back to Canada for a while and then came back in 93.
So the computer genes were running through your blood already.
It kind of was. But I, you know, when you hear a 12-year-old today say, well, you know, I started to learn how to code this week. And I'm like, yeah, well, I started to learn to code when I was 12, and it was a lot different, you know, 40 plus years ago than it is coding for 12-year-olds today. I always loved computers. I was hell-bent on going to medical school. That was what I really wanted to do. So went to Cal. You know, had some difficulty just with my stamina and getting around the campus. And
so, what's Cal?
Cal is UC Berkeley.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
Okay. Started off majoring in chemistry, thinking I was going to medical school. Decided after my second year, maybe medical school wasn't the best choice for me, and thought, well, you know what? There's this whole computer thing that I really like, and you know, I seem to be able to make money at this, so maybe this would be a good career. So I did that for a while. Then I decided to go to law school, thinking that I was going to do, you know, trademarks and copyrights and intellectual property, you know, the fancy end of the legal profession.
Is that because you could sort of see, like, is it because you're sort of sitting back and you could see sort of holes in certain sections that you could say, okay, no, I can take advantage of this, where that's going to really make it easier for a lot of people out there,
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. So I was basically a translator. The computer science people didn't understand law. The lawyers didn't understand technology. And I thought, hey, if I go to law school, I can be a high paid translator for the areas of the legal system where a background in both is really essential. And my last year of law school, we discovered that my daughter was losing her hearing, and I never ended up doing intellectual property. I went into advocacy for the deaf and then ended up in accessibility after that.
Yeah, that's pretty significant. Like, it's not just your disability, but it's also you got your daughter involved as well. Well, you know, because if she's born with a disability that she's got, so that's going to even, you know, that's going to amplify what you're doing. Yeah. So, because it's your disability and your family.
I have been known to go mama bear on people who refuse the caption.
No, I'm hearing you. Like, it's the same with myself.
I'm very well known for.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And that's great, because people have got to know, like, because there's so many people that, you know, ignorance is bliss, right? So, and there's a lot of people that where, you know, ableism in its true form, like, you see it left, right, and center. So, and like, my disability is acquired. Like, I've been a quad for just over a decade now, but my youngest brother, he was born with a disability. Like, he's on the spectrum. So, it's not like I've just known disability from the acquired disability that I have, but just growing up with it, how it affected my family, like, it was pretty full on. So I can understand from a certain degree when family's involved, you know what I mean? So when they're affected, like, when the mama bear or the brother bear comes out, you got to, you know, call to action. But so, yeah, just so keep talking, telling us about, because it's important to me as well, just not just the accessibility and just with some of the computer science that you've into and where that's evolved, but also because I can see it and hear it just in your voice, like the advocacy side as well. So has that always balanced, how is that balanced on its way up, like as you've grown through the corporate sector but also the advocacy?
I don't think you can be a successful accessibility manager in the US without being an advocate. And I would say in the US, it's even more important because we don't have socialized medicine. So we're not good at educating children with disabilities. Mm. So people with disabilities in the US tend to be in lower socioeconomic circumstances, which means their voices just aren't heard. And since so many decisions at the business level are made based on money and not looking at, well, are you trashing somebody's civil rights in order to make that money? Mm. I see that as being a significant problem. So I've always been, you know, an advocate bordering on probably a thorn in people's sides to make this happen, because that's the way I've found, you know, works. It gets it done. But if you look at everywhere I've worked in the field of accessibility, my goal has always been to have a broad-reaching impact on people with lots of different disabilities. So originally I worked in healthcare, where I tried to, you know, help an insurer become more accessible. Mm. And then I ended up running accessibility for some food related companies. And then the opportunity at VMware came up, and it harkens back to my technology roots. And I thought, well, you know, this is a company that's in 498 of the Fortune 500, the largest companies in the world. Almost every single one of them run VMware software, and nobody with a disability can use that software, which means nobody with a disability can get a job where that software is being used. And, you know, I don't want to say that I did it single-handedly, but I've gotten some things done in the 2 years, including our first fully accessible software release of our first product. You know, we always have a ways to go. Everybody always has things that they want to do that they haven't been able to get done. But I'm proud to say that I've been, you know, at least partially responsible for VMware being more inclusive towards people with disabilities.
Mm. No, that's great. So give us a bit of a brief about VMware, just a bit of a brief, and then we'll obviously dive deeper, but just, yeah, give us a bit of the scope.
So the VM for VMware is for virtual machine. So they were the original, one of the original cloud companies. So you could take a Macintosh and you could run a virtual machine on it and you could pretend that you were a PC. It would look and quack and totally behave like a PC and it would run PC software, but inside a Mac.
Right, and okay.
You could do the opposite. You could simulate a Mac on a PC.
Mm.
So that's where they started off. And now we do all kinds of cloud management, security, modern applications, a lot of end user computing, which has been really popular for COVID because it doesn't matter where you work. If you're running on VMware software, you can work anywhere.
Yeah, well, that's great. And that's it. Like since COVID, like the tech world's just gone bang through the roof in all different mediums. So, but then that does allow, you know, what we're doing now with myself talking to you and, you know, doing the podcast and, you know, where people with disability and where we can take advantage of that, and which is great. So,
well, the other thing is who could benefit from working from home more than somebody with a disability, right?
And that's
so
right.
For so long, we've heard, oh no, that's an undue burden. Like the healthcare company that I mentioned, I wanted to work from home 2 days a week. Oh no, we'll only let you work home from 1 day a week. 1 day a week, 2 days is an undue burden. Well, here we are, you know, X number of years later, and overnight they had 80,000 people working from home because of the pandemic. And all of a sudden it's not an undue burden anymore. I don't ever want to hear the phrase undue burden about a person with a disability asking to work from home ever again.
Yeah, yeah. I'm hearing you. So, and it's like the same over here in Australia where you can see, because I'm 2 hours north of Sydney. And I've worked a lot in the Sydney CBD over the years and know people that still work down that way and or where people aren't working down there anymore because of COVID. But you're seeing all these businesses, like it's like a ghost town down there because all these businesses can see where, okay, we don't need to spend all this money on commercial space. Everybody's working efficiently from home and, you know, they're making...
But then the sandwich shop closes, right? Because the sandwich shop relied on all the people in the buildings to go there for lunch, and the gymnasium closes. And, you know, so there is a lot of collateral damage, but, you know, it's really not any different than the Industrial Revolution. It's just on a different scale and on somebody else's timeline. It's clearly not on our timeline.
No. Well, the world's going to, you know, it's... We've never seen this before. Like we've gone through flu pandemics in the past over, you know, when you're talking about the Black Plague and then you got the Spanish flu and now we're getting hit with this. But yeah, we'll find our feet, or I should say our wheels again, and just see how we can just keep the motion moving forward. But, and talking about being like the wheels, being in a wheelchair. So, what's like, because I'm just, when you said Cal, like the University of California, right? University
yeah,
of California.
UC Berkeley.
UC Berkeley. Okay. So, like, always get intrigued. Like, I've been to Europe, right? And where I've been there in my chair and just seeing accessibility. So, what's, I'm always, whether it's got to do with transport or if it's got to do with a campus or major facilities, what's a facility, do they cater well, like for accessibility in general, like if it's to do with campus or other means over where you are?
Some places do it better than others. And also a lot depends on whether or not the buildings are older than 1990. So for buildings that are older, that predate the Americans with Disabilities Act, sometimes accessibility has to have been retrofitted in, and that's not always optimal. I had one class that I was just chronically late for when I was going to UC Berkeley. I still walked with my crutches, and there was a really, really steep hill that I could not get up. And so I had to take the long way around to get from one class to another class. I didn't account for that properly when I was doing my scheduling. And so that was a bit of a headache, but, you know, accessible parking is good. Accessible event types of things is usually fairly good. They almost always have sign language interpreters or captioning for people with hearing loss. It's the digital stuff. Honestly, it's the websites and the ticket registration and those bits that just haven't kept up to speed, even though the standards to make them accessible have existed for more than 20 years at this point. And so that's really what I'm focusing on now. So on the VMware campus, which is enormous, it's in Palo Alto, and it's 2.2 square miles, I think, just of VMware. Buildings, nothing else. All predating 1990, so they've been slowly, getting things better with things like electric doors and more accessible events and things like that as we went along. But it's really the digital maps and the booking transportation with Uber or trying to find out what the train schedule is. If you can't see, that can be really hard. And so that's really what I'm focused on now, is making all of those digital interfaces accessible.
Yeah, there's so many, like when you're looking at disability and the spectrum and what you're trying to cater for when it's accessibility, it's so vast. So when you've been in the game for a while and it's continuously growing. So, and talking about growth, and because you're going to be looking at the holes, is there anything that you can see that's getting worked on or that needs work, I should say?
So one of the things I was quite fortunate in that VMware can afford to allow me to work on some of these outside standards that are evolving. So I'm on three different major committee groups helping decide things like what is going to be the captioning guidelines for virtual reality, for example. That's one of the things that I'm working on, which is actually all kinds of fun.
That is cool.
The thing that's gotten more and more complicated, software has gotten more and more complicated, obviously, as we go forward.
That's right.
What you run today, you couldn't even dream of running 10 years ago.
Yeah.
We've gotten to the point where in the US, the disclosures about what is accessible about your products and what isn't have gotten very, very, very complicated.
It's always murky.
They can run between 40 and 100 pages, and usually the language is written, it sounds like somebody in marketing wrote it. It's like, this fancy thing does this, this, and this, and you're like, yeah, but does it work?
A lot of the legal knowledge that you've done in the past that would help in the line of work that you're in now, yeah?
So they're in the next major revision of the standard, which is called Silver. That's the project code name. So it's WCAG 3.0. It's going to be the next major revision. We're planning on
Is this just within your company, or you're talking?
This is globally.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure, so I wasn't too sure if it was just an internal thing.
No, this is globally, and in fact, there's companies in Australia that help companies follow this standard. So I've personally worked with Gian Wild at Accessibility Oz. She's got a fabulous company. Shout out to Gian. And there's another company called Intopia that I've heard of. That's based in Australia. I think they're working with Atlassian right now. For example, I've got five people who are legally blind that work with me on my team, and they they can't use Atlassian products because Atlassian products aren't accessible yet. So this is something that we're really pushing hard for the vendors to do, just like other companies are pushing us. Because if your major ticketing system or your major web page deployment doesn't work for somebody who's blind, it's going to be really hard for you to employ somebody who's blind because you've chosen inaccessible products.
That's great. So it's not just, America, like with yourself and with what you're doing, it's everywhere. So, because you're going to have all these, like yourself, all these other trailblazers from different parts of the globe. And,
the nice thing is we've all centralized on one standard. It's occasionally different versions of the standard. Like some people are still on an older version and some countries haven't adopted the new version yet. So like China, for example, is on an older version of the WCAG. The US we've stagnated for 4 years because the person in charge didn't care about people with disabilities except to make fun of them. So surprise, we are now on an older version of WCAG. Canada and the EU have passed us, hoping, you know, we'll catch up again sooner rather than later. But getting back
to are you running like a committee, like amongst like the different international...
Yeah, so there's a group called the W3C, which stands for the World Wide Web Consortium, and they are responsible for this standard. And it's all kinds of different people from government, different countries. There's people from Japan. I'm pretty sure there's somebody from Australia. Lots of participation from the EU, lots of participation from the US and Canada. And so we get together and we work out what the new standards need to be. And when technology evolves, we work out, okay, how did the standards have to evolve along with the technology to make sure people with disabilities aren't getting left out. So this scoring that's coming in the next version, you're not going to have to read these 40 to 100 page documents anymore to figure out how good accessibility is. We have a way of rolling it up to a score. And then you can look at one product and go, oh, look, you got a 3.7, and look at another product and go, oh, look, you got a 4.2. Guess what? The 4.2 product is the one that's more accessible.
So if anybody wants to suss out these markings of that scale, where would one go, like to throw into Google or whatever to type in so they can get some knowledge on this, what you're talking about?
So you just go to w3c.org. That's the parent organization site, and then look for the WCAG standard. You have to be careful just putting WCAG into Google, because when you do that, you get like 10 pages of ads of people trying to sell their magical WCAG consulting services. So I recommend going directly to the source, which is the W3C site.
Okay. Are there any... like legitimate consultants that do help in that regard?
There are lots of legitimate consultants. The problem is they're getting drowned by the illegitimate consultants. So a branch of a business broke out where people started saying, oh, look, you can use our tool and just add this one line of code and magically your site will be compliant. And it turns out now in the US, because we're a very litigious society, unfortunately, I think sometimes, says the lawyer, 10% of lawsuits that are being filed as of the end of 2020 were being filed against companies who had, you know, as the phrase I like to use, drunk the Kool-Aid. They believed all this marketing hype from these companies and installed these tools, didn't solve any of their underlying problems. Yeah. And surprise, the tools didn't do everything that they said they were going to. And so it's not preventing lawsuits from being filed. I'm hoping that eventually...
Are you serious?
And they're the ones who've bought all the sponsored ads on Google. So you don't see the legitimate companies. You see these people saying, hey, we can solve your problem for $450 a year, which is just absolutely categorically not possible.
Yeah, especially a lot when you're looking at the scale.
Kind of like I don't
scale
know
is the huge.
In the US, you can buy service animal certificates. It's basically the equivalent of
explain what that is, a service animal ticket.
Certificate. So you can,
certificate.
You can go online, you can pay, you know, some amount of money. And, you know, they have some medical person interview you and then certify that you need a service animal. So, you know, maybe you do and maybe you don't, but the way you went about it wasn't legitimate.
So what does that show? Does that show that you've been audited like your company and then you've got you're certified for something? Like, explain to me what's going on here. Like, what do you mean by that?
Oh, with the service animals?
Yeah.
It's just so that if somebody challenges you in public about whether, you know, if you have your dog in a no dog area.
I thought you meant that. Yeah. I just wanted to double check.
So that you can pull out your magical certificate and say, hey, my service animal's certified, leave me alone. But if you dig into the certification, there's nothing behind it. And the accessibility tools, the overlays, as they're called, because they overlay the websites, are exactly the same thing. You know, they make you think that externally, it looks like you've done something about accessibility, but in reality, you really haven't.
It just makes me sick when you've got, if it's individuals, companies, or whatever it may be, taking advantage of disability, it drives me nuts. So,
I was just going to say, people want to make a buck off of us without involving us.
100%. You know, there's blood in the water and the sharks are out. It does me head in. But so, disability in the digital space. So, like, what does it mean to you, accessibility and the awareness of it? Because you're looking at this not just from where you are in California, on the West Coast, America, you're involved on an international scale.
So some of the things that you think about are really straightforward. So for example, 8% of people who are male are colorblind. So there are certain rules in the accessibility guidelines about color choices so that you can make sure that somebody's not misinterpreting red and green and is actually, you know, making good decisions with all the same access to information that everybody else has. So that's number one. That's a really easy one for everybody to understand because just about everybody knows somebody who's colorblind.
I know. I'll jump in there just for a tick before you keep going because I know people where, that's just simple, colorblind, but I know the trajectory of that where if it's not sorted out with when they're young, because I know some particular people where it's just thrown them in a different path because they were colorblind and hasn't been picked up. And then, you know, where they've started playing up in the school classroom, and because they can't understand because they've got the teachers or other kids talking about certain colors or other situations, and where it's led to them not being able to read properly, not being able to write properly, and then the trajectory just sends them into a negative path when it could have been nipped in the bud, you know. So as simple as that.
I completely agree with you on that. You know, we talk about, you know, this mythical pipeline problem, that there aren't enough people with disabilities in the pipeline. Well, really what's happened is the pipeline's got a bunch of holes in it, right? So for example,
and it's leaking.
That's my point. So for example, we call it special education in the US. I don't know if that's what it's called in Australia or not, but we have We have one state in the US where 80% of children in special education drop out before high school is finished. They never even graduate.
Before high school.
Yeah.
That's insane. That's a huge percentage.
Not every state is like that. If I named the state, you probably wouldn't be surprised. Let's just say it's one of our, what we call our red states, our Republican states who don't want to spend money on children with disabilities.
Oh, so people with disability are just easier to put behind closed doors and keep them locked.
I wouldn't go quite that far, but it sure feels like it sometimes. but this is my point, right? So the problem isn't that we aren't in the pipeline. It's that the pipeline has holes in it and we're leaking out the entire way. You know, we don't graduate from high school, so we don't go to college. We struggle with college. Maybe we have a medical issue in the middle of college, have to take a break. It took me 5 years to finish my MBA because I had 4 surgeries in the middle of it. You know, I could have dropped out. I was stubborn, so I hung out with it.
Perseverance, good on you.
But that was hard. And didn't get a lot of support from my university, unfortunately. So, And people just trickle out the entire way. And that's where this pipeline thing comes from. I know in the US, the statistics are quite clear. You know, people with disabilities have been vastly more impacted by COVID because they're more likely to have customer service types of positions where they have to be face-to-face. They can't do the work from home. So twice as many of them have been laid off. You know, the unemployment rate for people with disabilities in the US is always more than double.
It's the same here in Australia too. Yeah.
And it doesn't need to be that way. If all of education was accessible, we would have the same opportunities as everybody else. And it wouldn't be at the whim of, oh, I had a dad who brought a computer home. You know, yes, I recognize that's absolute privilege, but that's what steered me to where I am today. And if everybody could use that computer, then everybody would have that opportunity.
Yeah, that's it. We've got to raise the bar, just elevate and broadcast, you know, the people out there like yourself that want to raise it up. And especially on these platforms, the digital space, there's so much room for people with disability to jump in and take advantage, but it's just knowing how, what, and where. So, and where it all starts. So when you're looking at the digital software and you're looking at the building blocks, the foundations, so talk us through the thought processes of that when you're thinking of, okay, I'm going to build some sort of software. What's the framework and what other occupations are sort of helped to bring in to build it up?
So good accessible software starts with good accessible design. That's never disputed. It's not always done that way, but when you understand why, because if you design something so you inherently can't make it work for somebody with a disability, let's say you design something with infinite scrolling, okay, where somebody, it's like Facebook, right? You can just keep on scrolling forever and more things will pop into your feed. Somebody who's blind really struggles to use that because they're never getting the information about, well, where is the end? And also, where am I in reference to where I started? You know, how many posts have I, am I into? Am I into yesterday's posts? Am I into the posts from last October? So infinite scrolling is something that's inherently difficult to make accessible. If you choose to use that in your design, you're automatically excluding people from disabilities from being able to use your end product. So I always tell people, don't try to build something from scratch. Go find something that works somehow similar to what it is you're trying to do and figure out what they did and just make it better. So a lot of time people will start with things called design systems. Right. So a design system is where you've got all these components already pre-built, like menus and dialogue boxes.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Yeah. So right. the crux of it's already there.
Yeah. So there's about 20 different design systems that are completely accessible and free. Okay. There are design systems that you can buy. Okay. But there's 20 where companies have said, you know what, this is good enough and we care enough that we're going to give this away. We're going to put this into the open source so that other people can use it. So VMware, my employer, decided.
Can you explain, I know what open source means, but can you explain just to the viewers and listeners what open source, because that adds a lot of girth and weight to programs or the digital space in general.
Sure. So open source means to me, and the definition differs a little bit depending on the license, but it means you don't have to pay for it. First of all, it's free. And usually what they want is they just want a small credit somewhere if you use it. So you could put it on your about page or in your footer. You could say this website was built with Material, or this website was built with Lightning, or this website was built with Clarity.
Yeah.
So Material is Google's open source. Lightning is Salesforce's open source. Clarity is VMware's open source design system. Mm-hmm. So we have an open source design system. There are still a few bugs. Every open source accessible design system has bugs. None of them are perfect.
Because you're going to have levels to what people can do when it comes to like building algorithms or whatever it may be, because you got open source where it starts with that singular idea and then it's all these other people that are just adding to the well, building it up.
Now, in the US, the de facto deployment platform for things that are open source is typically something called GitHub. So that's where VMware's Clarity design system is available. If you go to GitHub and search for Clarity, you can download the whole thing and then customize it to your heart's content.
So if you've got that structure right, so what are the occupations? Because we know some of your background, right? And what you're adding, and it like where it's to do with the accessibility, but to help that part of the accessibility, like if you're bringing in other occupations. What are those roles that help build up the framework?
Sure. So anything related to IT, if you make it accessible, is inherently going to work for people with disabilities. So I know we have a site recovery manager, for example, who works for VMware, who has a disability. We have people on the design team who have disabilities. Obviously, our accessibility team is probably close to half people with disabilities.
That's great.
So the idea is, whatever you build, if you make it work for somebody with a disability, you will find them eventually. They will come find you.
Yeah, 100%. So I'm always intrigued in how it works, and if you'd be able to give some insight into this, like when you're talking about AI, artificial intelligence, like, you know, it can be pretty small or pretty large, depending on how it works. But what I always get fascinated about is the way that some of these programs or some of the AI can learn on its own and mold and grow. So is there much of that you've brung into the mix in the past or what you're doing now?
People are going to think that I asked you to ask that question. So full disclaimer, Jake asked that question on his own.
100%. Yeah. And I'm not sort of going down the path of T2 Skynet Terminator stuff, but anyway.
No. So machine learning is starting to be a really big part of accessibility. And the way we use it at VMware is we have augmented our automated testing. So you can have a test that kind of looks at code and it tries to make decisions about whether is that coded accessibly or is that coded wrong? Can somebody with a disability use that?
Hold on. It can find out within itself if it's accessible or not. Mm-hmm. That's insane.
So that's what we're working on right now. So
before I mean insane as in great.
Yes, it is really awesome. So before machine learning approaches were used, this would work with about 30% of the accessibility guidelines. It was just a structured code analysis, and it would look at a list and it would say, okay, you know, did you do all these list things that you're supposed to do to make your list accessible? Great, you're a pass. No, you're a fail. Now what we can do is we can look at patterns. We can do image comparisons. So for example, one of the rules is you're supposed to always be able to track where you are if you're using a keyboard instead of a mouse. So the color, the box is supposed to change as you move along. That's one of the 50 WCAG rules right now. And there was no way to automate that before machine learning. Now we can take a screenshot. We can simulate a tab press. We can take another screenshot. We can compare the two images and we can say, hey, whatever's different, that's your focus indicator. That's the box. Right. And then we can test it and we can say, okay, is that a good focus indicator or is that a crappy focus indicator? Because there are rules around, you know, you can't have little dashed yellow thin lines because nobody's going to be able to see that, right? So even though you had a difference, that would still be flagged as a fail if you've got a good machine learning model. So VMware built that, also released on the open source. So it's available for free for anybody in the world who wants to use it. It's called Crest because it's built on top of the code analyzer, which is called Wave. So what do Waves do? They crest. So after you finish and cleaning up your stuff from the Wave tool, then you can run Crest and do all the machine learning things on top of it.
Ah, okay. So you're building some of the main components and then you're having Crest like to machine learn the edges of it, just polish it up pretty much. Yeah,
exactly. So it looks at the language, it looks at the images, it looks at patterns, and it will make a pass fail determination based on things above and beyond the code.
But beyond the code, does it realize what, like when you were talking about what the global standard is, right? When you're talking about silver, does it know that?
We've written it to the WCAG 2.1 standard, which is the current standard. We're in the process of updating it for the 2.2 standard, which is coming out in June. And then eventually we'll have to overhaul it a bit for the silver standard when that's final. That's still very much under development right now.
So apart from VMware, when you're looking at the standards of that, it can recognize it, right? So because you've got a cast of thousands, millions, when you're talking about all these new apps that are in development, all these new programs that are in development, software, digital space. So do they have to, depending on where they are, and like they should all, you know, earn their stripes when it's got to do with accessibility, right? But is there like an international sort of threshold where they have to tick the boxes to earn a certain level to be, and to say, yep, you've been certified with this stamp. Now you can be an app or be a digital software and be out in the atmosphere for millions of people to use.
So the box ticking is generally done by the federal governments, the provincial, or in the US, we would say state governments, yeah, and the people who get money from them. So, you know what? I just had this random thought cross through my mind. You know, one of the top screen readers in the world is Australian. It's called NVDA, which stands for non-visual desktop access. And people who are blind who use PCs,
yep,
love it. And again, yep, it's open source, it's free, where the competitor to that is over $1,000 US per machine. So that if somebody's interested in trying out a screen reader, I would definitely go to nvaccess.org and download the screen reader, and you can see what the experience is like for somebody who can't see.
Oh, I'm glad you had that thought bubble that popped in, you know, because that's great. Any sort of edge that it gives to anybody with a disability, no matter if it's hearing impaired or vision impaired, sensory, like there's so much to cater for, but there's so much out there too. And if you got open source compared to, you know, you're talking about $1,000 US, and when they're on par with each other, but then you got people that want to keep building to an open source component, like what are you going to go with, you know? So, and when you're looking at the percentages of all those percentages that you've thrown out there, so if you got people that are dropping out before high school, you've got disability as a whole, like compared to the general population, you're not going to have a whole lot of cash in the back pocket.
Right.
So what are you going to be going with?
It's really important to make assistive technology available as cheaply as possible. That's part of leveling the playing field for everybody.
100%. And I know
you were asking me about certifications. So there aren't really, yes, any standalone certifications. But what you can do is you can say, I am, you know, whatever level compliant. And some governments have set standards for the minimum level of compliance they will accept for new software purchases. So if you want to sell to that audience, then you have to be accessible or you won't even get to be able to put in a bid.
Okay. So talking about, if we go down like certification, if we're talking about the who's who, without naming names, but when you're talking about some of the big players in the digital space, software, social media, or whatever it may be, what's your experience? Do you think that they've got a lot to work on when it comes to accessibility, or if you're talking to other people with disabilities that
I keep on seeing these organizations hiring, and presumably some of the people that they're hiring have to have disabilities. So I would say in your part of the world, probably the two strongest organizations for providing accessibility consulting are Cognizant and HCL. They both have huge accessibility practices based in India, but the people who work in these practices have been certified to the international standard. So you can get certifications for training. There are tests that individuals can take to say, I'm competent at this.
Yeah, they're held accountable. Yeah.
Right. There's just no final certification for products at this moment that's meaningful. So HCL and Cognizant are two that I've worked with in India. And then there's several US-based organizations as well. But of course, they tend to be more expensive because the cost of living is much higher in the US than it is in India.
Is there a bit of talk about it, though, like when you're talking to some of the other community members around the globe about where hopefully there is a standard where these software or digital developers have to get to this benchmark to be active and live?
There is not right now. So the motivation for doing individual certification right now is competitive. An organization that has half of its teams with a U.S. certification is going to do better at it than, you know, a team that's only got 10 or 15% of their people certified. So it's more of a marketing thing right now than it is, you know, whether or not the end product is accessible.
Okay. And accessibility, when you're trying to cater for all these different types of disabilities, sensory, hearing, vision, physical, and the rest, what's the hardest to cater for? Like, on that's a tricky question, but when you're like, oh, it's so much harder to...
I've kind of got two answers. So my first answer is people who use screen readers. The web is inherently visual, and so making it work for somebody who doesn't have visual input is really hard. If you look at the guidelines, half of the guidelines pertain to vision loss. But to me, that's just a matter of discipline. To me, the hardest is autism and neurodiversity, because you can't simulate those. I can simulate sort of being blind. I can turn off my screen. I can use a screen reader. I won't have exactly the same experience a blind person will have, but it's not going to be like way, way super far off. It's going to be at least a little bit close. You can't simulate autism. You can't simulate dyslexia. It's just not possible. So I personally find the neurodiverse category the most difficult to comply with, because I feel like the standards are well defined for vision loss. You just have to follow them.
True. Yeah. So, and this is like, if you're talking about some of the big industrial designers, when you're talking about like Apple, or you're talking about some of the other companies where they go design first and then the rest follows, because they want everything to fit into it. So has it been troublesome, like, over the years where you're trying to work with an industrial designer because you've got accessibility in your mind of how the software works, and it's going to go physically into some sort of component, whether if that might be some big screen or if it's just in general like a tablet, phone or computer, because you're thinking of those steps, or you have an input from other people with disability about, yeah, we know the software, but how's the interface gonna all work together cohesively, you know?
Yeah, so one of the things that I worked on at a previous job was one of these soda dispensing machines where you could choose your flavor off the screen of the machine.
Right.
But it was just a glass touch screen interface. There was nothing to tell a person who was blind, you know, whether they were selecting root beer or raspberry iced tea. And so we actually built an app where the app connected to the soda machine via Bluetooth.
Nice.
And the app was accessible. So the person could say, you know, I want a diet Sprite and, you know, I want 30% this other flavor instead. And it would actually custom mix that for them. But it was the app driving the machine, not making the machine accessible, but providing an alternate accessible interface. So there's that, which is that falls under the category of kind of Internet of Things. Where you can control your lighting system and your heat and ordering things from Alexa, all from an accessible interface. But it's not because the device itself is accessible. It's because they've built a separate interface for it that is accessible. My pet peeve is laptops that weigh like a brick. And so I used to go through airports a lot in my wheelchair by myself.
Right.
And I've got terrible arthritis in my hands. And so anything that weighed like more than 3 pounds, which is like, what, a kilo and a half, maybe 1,400 grams, it would just be too much for me to manage, especially if I had to change airports and I didn't have a direct flight. So a company came out with a new brand of laptop that the entire thing, the laptop, the device, the charging cord, the keyboard, everything put together weighed exactly a kilo. And I'm like, I'm a customer for life. Because for somebody else, they might think, oh, well, 400 grams, that doesn't really matter. But for me, 400 grams matters.
Yeah, it's big deal.
So, anyways, for the Internet of Things, people who are doing those types of devices, make sure your apps are accessible, because you will never be able to make like the little teeny tiny switches on the thermostat accessible. There's just no way. But if you have an app that controls it and your app is accessible, it doesn't matter that the person can't reach the teeny tiny switches. They can do it from their phone.
That's a great way to look at it. Well, that makes me think differently as well. Like, not just to, because I use a lot of equipment that has accessibility features, but then I do use some that do talk to others. But just to really push that out there, like, I think that's going to make a lot of people think differently in that space of just how to get a lot of these, the current apps, where getting them talking to each other, you know, to make them accessible. If that actual, whatever it may be, that interface isn't working, design something around it that is accessible to that person with that particular disability, that's gonna have the right sourced interface to make it work.
Yeah, I always tell people that the Americans with Disabilities Act did not make stairs illegal. Okay, what it said was that you had to have a ramp and an elevator that connects everything that you can get to by the stairs. And so in the case that we were just talking about the thermostat with the little teeny tiny switches that you can't reach, you know, the teeny tiny switches are the stairs. That's fine. You can still have them, but you have to provide the ramp.
Yeah, true.
Which is the app to control it with.
That's great. And do you hear much over in the States? Because you always hear of a lot of progression over where you are in regards to, like, when we're talking about interfaces, right? So I'm not going down the path a lot, T2 Terminator or any of that sort of stuff. But when you're looking at interface and the software, the digital space, when you're talking about, like, which does help people with disabilities, where you're talking about exoskeletons or anything to do with Boston Dynamics, or if you got Elon Musk where he's bringing up Neuralink, where that can help, you know, if someone like myself, like with a spinal cord injury, where it can help certain pathways talk to each other, do you hear much of that?
I think the biggest breakthrough I've seen on that, and I don't know if this is true in Australia or not, is 3D printing. So, for example, if I have leg braces that I spent a ridiculous amount of money on after my last foot surgery, so maybe eight years ago. I think they were $1,300 US. And it took weeks for them to come and, you know, all the back and forth and appointments and everything. I think if I needed those braces again today, I would get the prescription with the numbers. And then I could take it to somebody and have it 3D printed. And so that's
great. That's
something that's been a relatively recent change. You know, maybe it's gotten stronger over the last couple of years. I know a gentleman down in Southern California who was 3D printing the face shields. For a while, we had all those, we had a severe shortage of masks and face shields in the US. And so he figured out how to 3D print them. And then he cranked out like 2,000 of them in a weekend.
Wow.
to take to the hospital. So those kinds of things are possible now. You don't need big, you know, plastic molding manufacturing facilities anymore to do stuff like that. You need somebody who understands software and can feed the pattern into the 3D printer.
That's right. And I've seen that over here too as well, like where it does get utilized for people with disability. Like, it might be a little thing, like where, say, with myself, I've got limited hand dexterity, and if I want to fly a drone but I can't use a joystick, so they'll 3D print like a larger joystick that's got a hollow insert that can just plop straight over the top of the joystick that's on the controller. So then you got more hand dexterity to actually fly the drone itself, and but other things where it does help, not just for activities, but what you're talking about as well, where it's actually helping you with some other physical aspects, where it might be a prosthetic.
Right. And I was just about to say, like, especially in developing nations, they can 3D print a prosthetic.
That's huge.
For like $25 or $50 now.
That's right. And where I see these designs and where you might have open source attached, and it's like people continuously adding to the design, and then you can just go on the internet and see what works for you, and then just float that file straight through to your 3D printer, then bang, thanks for coming, you know. So
it's especially important for parents of children, because prosthetics are expensive, right? Mm. And as you're a child, you outgrow them over time. It might take, I don't know, 6, 8 maybe prosthetic legs for a child as they get older, and by being able to 3D print them, you're making it a lot easier and a lot more cost effective,
but learning the skill, learning the trade, and where you're helping yourself, but that in turn can help to, you know, if you'd be helping other people out there also. But with some of the, like, you've climbed up through the corporate ladder, and when you're looking at barriers and accessibility, like whether it's got to do with like the work that you're doing or just some of the physical aspects of it, what's some of the barriers that you've come up against? Like, and if we can throw some negatives in there where it helps people out there, but we'll throw some positive stuff in there as well.
Yeah, so I think my biggest barriers have been dealing with countries that don't have a Disability Rights Act. I mean, in Australia, you've got the DDA. It's quite strong. It's
spot similar, on.
Yeah, it's similar to the ADA in the US. Mm. But VMware has people employed in countries where there's no accessibility laws, or what they have isn't enforced, is sometimes the flip side of it. So for example, if I'm working with somebody in Eastern Europe, and I'm not going to name a particular country, I don't want to get hate mail from people from that country.
No.
But they're less likely to have disability related laws, and they're less likely to have seen somebody with a visible disability in their workplace, right? So if all the buildings have stairs in your country, that's going to be a problem. You're not going to get very many wheelchair using employees there, because they're not going to be able to get around because of the stairs. So I think it's getting the mind shift to seeing people with disabilities as potential customers and potential coworkers, and not so much the, as you mentioned, about the state that shall not be named in the US, where they keep their children behind locked doors. But you know, that's sometimes what ends up happening. If you don't have the education system, you're not going to get the workforce.
No, you just got to chip away, keep chipping away, just to show that awareness, and hopefully that grows and you get a cultural shift, you know. So, and you've seen a bit of that progress, yeah? Like, even though we touched on what?
Oh, I've definitely seen progress within VMware communities, for sure. And then, you know, people don't stay employed with the same company for 40 years anymore like they did in my father's day. So I expect people will come and people will go. And, you know, I'm hoping that the values that I've helped instill with some of the people who may have thought about disability differently when they started, that they carry that to their new employer.
And how can it improve, you reckon? Because this is going to be ongoing. So, like, we're in a good space, and where good developments are being made, but where can improvements be made, you reckon?
Well, I always say that accessibility is a program, not a project. I'm not really looking for an exit point, given where we are with society and technology right now. I would hope that someday that the ethics of using technology would keep up with the rate at which it evolves. But right now, that's not the case. So people evolve new technology, and then we figure out how to make it work for people with disabilities. And then they evolve a new technology, and we make it figure out how to work for people
that's
with disabilities.
It.
So I'd
just
like
to keep up.
Included with the revolution would be nice. That would be the improvement that I hope to see in my lifetime.
I like that. Keep up with the revolution, you know. Stay up with the arms race. So, okay, righto. So tell us a bit about your blogs. Is it just about accessibility in the digital space, or do you cover all different types of topics in general?
Well, like many hobbies, shall we say, it started because I was pissed off about something. So I had a coworker in the accessibility field, and I went one way, and he was looking for a new job. And he had a great interview, went really well. And then they told him at the end that he didn't know enough about one particular tiny piece of accessibility technology. And so they weren't hiring him because of that. And I thought that was the dumbest thing ever, because they missed out on this guy who was committed, who cared, who, you know, was a problem solver, you know, because he didn't know this one little tiny corner of accessibility. And so I got really angry. And I wrote about that. And then it just sort of evolved from there. So I've been blogging twice a week for a little bit over 2 years now.
Nice.
I did get named the Medium Blogger of the Year last year by their largest, the UX Collective, their largest publication.
Yeah,
so
okay.
Pretty proud of that.
Yeah, you should be.
But basically anything that touches on disability, I write about it. I try to make sure that one of the articles every week is specifically about something technical about accessibility and how to do it.
Yep.
But I've written about how I'm annoyed because, you know, they never have the singer and the signer for the Star Spangled Banner and the Super Bowl in the same frame. And it still didn't happen this year. At least they talked about him in advance. I knew who it was going to be. But if you want to see the signing of the Star Spangled Banner, either they'll cut to it for like 5 seconds while the person's singing, or you have to go watch it on YouTube afterwards. And I feel like, you know, equal billing should be the case for these things. So
100%.
You know, I talk about how god awful the American insurance system is.
Oh. Yeah, and talking about the insurance system, right? So I'll throw this in the mix because I'm always curious of this because in Australia we've got the National Disability Insurance Scheme that looks after Australians as a whole with disability, right? And where that's, you know, the money that goes to some of the caring agencies to help people with disabilities. And there's all sorts of different factors that come into it. But do you guys over there have like a scheme or anything of the like that looks after people with disabilities, like on a federal level, or you got state
stuff?
We do,
but you have to be stone cold broke and unable to work to qualify for it. That actually, they require that people be in poverty. Mm. I know of married couples who've gotten divorced so that the one spouse can be poor enough to qualify for the assistance.
Yeah, right.
It's really terrible. I don't have anything good to say about it at all.
Okay. Well, that's another can of worms. That's probably a whole separate podcast on its own.
Could be. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. It's all private insurance and it's all tied to your workplace. So this was an evolution in the US around World War II, when in World War II, the government banned giving people bonuses for work. So instead, because they couldn't pay you a bonus, mm-hmm. they started handing out health insurance instead as a kind of an end run. You know, it was a bonus, right?
So,
and then that ended up, the system ended up evolving from there. It just took a life of its own.
That sucks. But hopefully it improves. So before we wrap everything up, so how can, from your point of view, with COVID and the world we live in now, how can people with disability take advantage of tech and make it work for them?
I would say the number one thing that we can do is don't be quiet. If you're gonna, so there was a study that went on in England where 91% of people with disabilities who were interviewed said that they had left a shop or had left the website because it wasn't accessible and gone to the competitor, but never complained about it. When you don't complain about it, people don't realize that they're losing money over this, right? Mm. This is not a place where silence is going to benefit people. You have to speak up, and you have to speak up loudly, no matter how uncomfortable it might be for you personally to do that.
Good stuff. No, that's it. Just high tide raises all canoes. It's just being vocal and broadcasting and getting the message out there.
That's what I'd like to think. Yeah. So, you know, definitely. And don't think, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to email this person because they're, you know, I'll never hear back from them. You know, you never know where something is going to get routed. Just send it. What's the worst thing that you're going to get? Silence, right? Well, that's, you know, not any different from not emailing them at all. So at least you're buying a bit of a chance to actually get some change made.
100% change, make it happen. So let's throw out in the atmosphere, if anybody wants to contact you or look at your blogs, social media, whatever it may be, do you want to just throw that out in the atmosphere?
Sure. So Medium itself is not totally accessible. So plus they charge, right? They give you like 5 free articles a month, and after that you have to pay. So I have my Medium blog, which is S Bernhaber. So SBYRNEHABER.medium.com. And then once a month, I pick up all those articles and I republish them on my accessible WordPress site, which is just sherrybernhaber.com, you know, S-H-E-R-I, and then the Bernhaber again, with no hyphen. Internet doesn't like hyphens. And that's where people can find me.
Beautiful. All right. Well, you keep chipping away and doing the great work that you're doing in the whole digital space, because a lot of people are starting to jump in, people with disability and people that aren't, and trying to really push forward with like what we're doing now, just having this talk. I'm on the Central Coast, New South Wales, and you're in California over in the US, and just being able to make these things work and just being able to spread the awareness and take advantage. So, Sherry.
Well, that's great. I've really enjoyed this, and yep. Have me back in a year and I can talk about the most recent WCAG 2.2 upgrade. And then another year after that, I'll be able to talk about Silver and that scoring mechanism that I introduced your listeners to today.
That'd be great. All right. Well, you take care and we'll talk soon.
Sounds good. Thank you. Jake.
Beauty. See you, folks. Sherry Bernhaber, accessibility in the digital landscape. She's all over it like a lampshade. And hey, if that yarn resonates with you, or you want to look into the digital accessibility environment, hit her up. Like, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And it's good to see what she's doing in the backyard of California, but what she's doing digitally with accessibility and how she's applying that on a global scale. Solid work. And if you like the yarn, hit that subscribe button. Be much appreciated. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at StraightRollingCheetah. Or email one word, straightrollingcheetah@gmail.com. Or we've also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs. So check it out. I want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, greatest electrical chairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto. See you on the next one.